Thank you. I do warn you, I'm probably going to ask far more questions than give answers. And as Richard has just said, thank you, don't we all know? So maybe coals to Newcastle. But I'd like to share some of these thoughts with you. Now, this title, The Difficulties of Living a Spiritual Life in Our Current Society, is a question, or perhaps we more accurately could call it a problem, that frequently raises its head for anyone for whom the great teachings of any great world faith or the ageless wisdom is anything more than academic. Indeed, depending on how close to your heart the great teachings lie, it can, of course, be positively intrusive into our lives. This divine discontent that is said to continually interrupt the even tenor of our way. You know, I think it is true to say that once unleashed, the hound of heaven is never very far from our heels. Now, our theme for the weekend is In Touch with the Infinite. And that's lovely, isn't it? It really is very beautiful. And I can't think of an environment that is more suitable for this kind of thinking. And I want to pause here a moment in thought, because it provides me with a springboard for which I can share some thoughts with you. Now, it must surely be true to say that we are all, everywhere, at every single moment, in touch with the infinite, that divine presence that people call God. The fact that most of us, most of the time, are unaware of it, forgetful of it, possibly even indifferent to it, in no way invalidates the truth of the matter. This wonderful concept, and it is a wonderful concept, of omnipresence occurs and reoccurs through all the great world faith, through all great thinking, and through all great teachings. You know, it says in that lovely scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, all's then God, than me, there is none other. What a thought, what a thought. You know, I often say to theosophical students in the Northwest at our training center, consider the implications. It's not so much what is explicit in a sentence or a phrase, but what is implicit, what is implied, that has the power. All's then God. All? Than me, there is none other. There's no me and no thee. It's all one. It's all God. And if we look to the Oxyrhynchus fragments of the Christian teachings, lift the stone and thou shalt find me. Cleave the wood and I am there. What a thought. And if you really believe that, you'd never lift up a pebble and look at it in the same way again, would you? Not if you really believed it. And going further back, whither shall I flee from thy presence? Everywhere, everywhere, wherever we look. And so it must be true to say that wherever your feet may tread, wherever your eye may fall, and whatever your hand might touch, then there is the one life, the one love, the one consciousness, the one that embraces all. The significance, the implication is tremendous. You know, when Lillian spoke this morning, she mentioned a feeling of awe and wonder. And I was so glad she did, because sometimes we get a little blasé, don't we? And we get a little bit grown up, whatever that really means, I'm never quite sure, or a little bit sophisticated. And we tend to lose that sense of wonder and become a little arid somewhere inside of ourselves. And if we're really in touch with the infinite, that could never happen. You know, I think it was the ancient Greeks who said, wonder at the things before you, for wonder is the beginning of knowledge. And that's true, isn't it? You've got to wonder first. Thinking about this theme, I was reminded of that lovely book by Ralph Waldo Trine. You remember, In Tune with the Infinite? Now, the one is not necessarily synonymous with the other. And right through that book is, again, implicit the need for a realignment of oneself. This is a process, this is a discipline, which is very much part of the spiritual life. Now, sooner or later, all this and all that it implies impinges upon us sufficiently to draw a response from deep within us. And if you couple that with our own inner needs, which sooner or later in our age-long history break surface, the need to search for the temple of wisdom and understanding, the need to know and understand, or possibly the need to reach out and touch the hem of love's garment. It's all really part of the same thing. Put the two together, and then our attention begins to turn to what we have termed the spiritual life and all that that implies. The difficulties arise when we start to turn theory into practice, or perhaps I should say when we try to turn theory into practice. When we say the spiritual life, just what do we mean? And I would say to you, let us not underestimate this. As soon as the concepts of the great teachings become precepts, and a precept is an axiom for action, as soon as concepts which take place up here become precepts in our lives, then we have no choice but to begin to march to the beat of a different drum. And that is to invite difficulties in our current society. We're out of step. We've broken the step. Indeed, more than that, we've stepped out of the ranks. And we're trying to live life according to totally different yardsticks. Priorities, values, outlooks, standards, all have to change. We could never again have the same touchstone as regard lives. We change, we begin to change, but alas, that current society around us doesn't always change. And what do we find? Well, we find, for example, that all is no longer necessarily fair in love and war, as one is constantly reminded. And we needs must stand up and be counted. Not noisily, nor aggressively, but enough to be true to our professed belief. To approach a higher way of life is to learn very swiftly, again in the words of Francis Thompson, that all things betray thee who betrayest me. And that suddenly matters. It matters a lot. And we find that we really must do unto others that which we would have them do unto us. And conversely, we must not do unto others that which we would have them not do unto us. And what do I mean by do? Not just physical action, in my thinking and in my feeling. That's a tall order, tremendously tall order. And I find I've even got to love everybody. Well, I mean, how's that for starters? Perhaps we don't even know what love really means. And that no matter how I feel about things, this current society that perhaps is making things difficult now for me is nevertheless entitled to call upon us at any time in any of its needs. Now, all of this involves us in radical change. And this would be difficult enough if everything was going for us. But you see, it's got to be done in the days and nights of our everyday lives, in the midst of its laughter and its tears, its joy and its pain. It has to be done from within, from within a society, an environment, whose atmosphere, whose rate of vibration, whose general conditions are, on the whole, anything but conducive, and can sometimes be totally obstructive. Now, I want to ask you to think a little further with me, if you will, about living the spiritual life, because I suggest that to get our thinking reasonably clear at this point can well save ourselves unnecessary conflict, particularly in the initial stages. Let's start by taking it to a relative but possibly valid extreme. And here I want to refer you to the words of the great teacher. And he was speaking in this context. And you remember what he said? He was talking about the narrow way, the spiritual life. Straight is the gate, and narrow is the way that leadeth to life eternal. And few there be who find it. And the world is full of lovely, kindly people. Nevertheless, said the Great One, few there be who find it. And if you want to turn your attention to the great Eastern scripture, again, the Bhagavad Gita, What did the Great One say there? Of many thousand mortals, one perchance striveth for truth. And of those few who strive, nay, and rise high, one only here and there knoweth me as I am, the very truth. Is this what we're talking about when we say the spiritual life? 'Tis a way of self-abnegation. And at our stage, what on earth is there to say about it? The bringing to a zenith, to a wholeness, to a fulfillment, all that we've ever considered about, all that we've ever heard about, read about, being taught. This, of course, for most of us, is the way ahead, one day. The way that leads to a peace and a love and a joy that passeth the present understanding. It's the ultimate heritage of us all. And we've only to look around the world to see how much it needs it, even in a small dose. And to find it is to practice self-renunciation. You remember the story of Jesus and the rich young man who came to him, said, Master, I would follow thee. Full of wonder, full of enthusiasm, raring to go. And that's great, that's great. Lovely to see and have that response. And you remember the words of the Master? He told him to sort of sell all he had and follow him. And he couldn't do it. He couldn't do it. And the Master was sad because he said he was so near. And I remember for many, many years one used to think, well, there it is, you see. No matter how enthusiastic we are, we can't let go. And no doubt that is the ultimate moral of the story. But you know, I remember having it pointed out, and it gave me much food for thought. The young man was part of his current society. Maybe he had dependents, commitments, responsibilities. Was he going to say, tough, I want to pursue my own spiritual destiny. You're on your own. These things are not always totally black and white, I don't think. We need to look into them very carefully. And I feel very strongly, and perhaps some of you will agree with me, that we need to beware of falling into the trap of talking about that which is spiritual, even thinking too glibly about it. Obviously, for every thinking person, it enters into our study, into our awareness. And we needs must make the effort to consider it, to try to understand it and absorb it as best we can. Anybody who starts thinking beyond the narrow periphery of their own personal world automatically must sooner or later approach the periphery of the spiritual world. But always, always recognizing that here, really, we're out of our depth and the waters run very, very deep. I want to refer you again to another story. This time, I think it was Matthew. And you remember the incident when it was requested of the Master that two brothers be allowed to sit on thy right and thy left hand when you enter the kingdom. Tremendous request. May we sit on your right and your left hand. But do you remember the response? The Great One said, ye know not what ye ask. Can you drink of the cup that I drink of? And my goodness, friends, I remember how that brought me to a very abrupt halt. And I often think that we too sometimes not only know not what we ask, we know not what we say. Can we drink of that same cup? In a sense, where is the spiritual life leading us? Well, I want to suggest, though I really must be careful not to be sidetracked here. You know, Richard, I find in any talk on theosophy, every single sentence opens itself to wonderful, exciting digressions. Yes? You know, and one could branch off and spend a whole morning or afternoon just discussing them. So I mustn't do this. But I want to suggest to you that one aspect of the spiritual life is the release of the redemptive factor into your life and into your world. Redemptive factor that lies deep, deep within us. We need it, and our world needs it. Even our current society needs it. But this, of course, is the culminating and greatest task of all. It's the quest, if you like, of the Holy Grail, And generally speaking, current society does not want to know, apart possibly from the occasional academic interest. Now, I must say a word here about current society. You know, it's inevitable in a talk with this title to sound hypercritical, because we are making comparisons. And I'm not intending to be critical. Well, not unduly. I'm certainly not intending to be patronizing. There is nothing worse than that ghastly holier-than-thou attitude. You know, no matter how we aspire or what we hope to do, we are all part of current society, you and I, and we help to make up current society. So I've got this very much in mind. So I'm going to sound critical at times, but it's only because I'm in that rather awkward position of having to make comparisons. Now, how are we going to define current society? Well, let me turn again to the great one. Broad is the way that leadeth to destruction, and many there be who walk therein. Now that sounds like a load of gloom and doom, doesn't it? It really does. But I don't honestly think it's meant to be as ominous as all that. What is this seemingly ominous road that is so wide that many walk thereon and that leadeth to destruction? And I remember hearing a lecture many years ago that suggested that they were never intended to be derogatory words, but just a plain statement of fact. And if we ask ourselves a couple of questions, I think we very soon see this. For example, what is it that leads to the process rather dramatically termed as destruction? And secondly, what is the general way of the majority of people? Most of us, most of the time. Well, if in this context we defined destruction as that which follows or is part of change, dissolution, and decay. And I remember hearing the words that, you know, change and decay and all around I see. It's part of the everyday world. It's part of the material and mundane world. And if we remind ourselves that for most of the world, the way is the way of the personality, then we have our answer. What do I mean by the personality? This physical body? This area of energy around me that I term emotion and feeling? And that further area of energy around me that is mental? It's all matter. It's all vibration of its own kind. But it's subject to change, dissolution, and decay. And that's the way of the personality. And for many, many people, that is everything. There is nothing beyond that. One of the perhaps sad things about our world. So the broad way is but the way of the personality. And even when we begin to learn better and think we know better, most of us, for most of the time, are personality orientated. Perhaps life does that to us. And there we have it. And let us note well, it's a way that has its natural and its essential place, and it has a tremendous amount to teach. It's one that has an essential role to play in the great evolutionary process. A process, as Lillian pointed out this morning, takes place within us and without us. And all its lessons, all of them, have to be learned. All its potential, and there is an enormous amount of potential in the world of the personality, has to be explored, understood, and all its resources released and used. Even so, having said that, all things here are perishable. 'Tis the level, 'tis the road on which we're told moth and rust do corrupt. And these vehicles of ours, physical, emotional, and mental, being subject to the states or the processes of change, dissolution, and decay, are consequently vulnerable to that process of release that we call death, that leads to disintegration, or if you like, destruction. Destruction that really only leads to transition. But this is normal, it's not reprehensible, and it involves us all. Its reality is relative, and it comes but to pass. I'd like to quote to you here. The broad way then, that of the personal world, is necessary, and we must all tread it for very many lives, until we reach the great awakening. the beginning possibly of trying to lead the spiritual life. For none can begin to tread the other way who has not exhausted all the possibilities of the broad way. And this is not a matter, he said, for self-reproach, but let us not deceive ourselves. To the extent that we are immersed in the personality, and all our reactions to life are based upon how we feel physically, emotionally, and mentally, then to that extent do we tread the broad way. That is where our treasure is, therefore that is where our hearts are. Again, to that extent, with the many, we walk the broad way. I was going to say there's no future in it. And there isn't, is there? Not really, not really. But again, generally speaking, for current society, that is life, in inverted commas. You know, I'm going to have to keep saying generally speaking, because I'm always very, very aware that there are always exceptions, and it's the exception that proves the rule. But if I push it into every sentence, it's going to become monotonous. So will you take it as said, please? These are general, not specific statements. And I'm very conscious of that beautiful line from the Desiderata that everywhere life is full of heroism. For many, many people, just getting through the day with dignity and serenity calls for tremendous courage, tremendous resilience that must be rooted in the spiritual path in themselves. And I am totally aware of that. So I would ask you, please, to take that as understood. Now, what is the general... I can't get away from that word, can I? What is the general reaction? Certainly initially, even to attempts to walk the spiritual path, any attempt to walk the spiritual path in its midst. And the reactions range from a raised eyebrow to puzzlement to wariness, suspicion, skepticism, on to derision, and very often as far as downright hostility. And this is not easy to combat because we're living right in the middle of it. And sometimes it comes from those who are close to us. And to even to begin to think about walking the spiritual life immediately places us in a vulnerable position. I don't want to digress here, but I must make this comment, and perhaps we're all aware of it, that as soon as we decide to do this, we're really inviting life itself to throw down the gauntlet and test us. And that's quite enough with everything coming in from us from the outside. You see, for some reason or other, the very thought of anyone in their midst living the spiritual life tends to prompt people to assume a defensive attitude, which can very quickly and very easily become aggressive. I gather it's okay if you pop off and do it somewhere else, you know? If you go into retreat or move yourself, and one gathers, well, that's reasonably acceptable, but don't do it here. I think it was one of the cardinals of Rome who once said that saints are impossible people to live with, and I'm ready to believe that, but we're a long, long way from that. And perhaps one of the outstanding characteristics, and it's a very distressing one in the early stage, it comes under the heading of loneliness. I've lost count of the number of people who have said to me, I do find I'm very much on my own, one way or another. I remember speaking to a young man, and I'm going back a long way, in Bolton Lodge, and we were talking about it, theosophy, and he was saying how much the great teachings meant to him. And for some reason I said, well, you know, do you talk to it with your colleagues? And he said, well, I'm a labourer. And he said, I would not dare, and he was a strong, hefty lad, he said, I would not dare to talk about it to my fellow workers and labourers. And he said, I mean dare. And I was quite young at the time, and I was quite appalled. You know, where's the concept to live and let live? I remember somebody else saying to me, I couldn't talk about it with my mates, they'd think I'd gone soft in the head. You know, and he meant that. One gets used to being thought a little odd, a little way out perhaps, but that's fair enough. Only a little time ago, somebody came to me after a talk and said, you know, I've been thinking these thoughts, she wasn't a member, for many, many years, and I'd come to the conclusion that I was totally on my own. My friends don't want to know, my family don't want to know, and It had caused her a great deal of distress. And perhaps for those of us who have the opportunity to share our thinking on this matter, we don't necessarily always have to agree on the details, but who can share, and that's the wonderful thing about coming together and sharing our thoughts and ideas, I think we can forget how distressing isolation can be. And these people, we sometimes are isolated. For some reason, it causes intense irritation, sometimes to one's own family. One of my own members experiences this with her own sister, who's constantly puzzled why, from being a very bad depressive, she has become serene and found a purpose and a cheerfulness in life. And she keeps saying, well, what have you got, you see? And then as soon as she tries to tell her, she doesn't want to know. She's thoroughly irritated with the whole business. And all she says is, well, you can't prove it. It seems to rouse this kind of reaction in current society. And we can become alien. We can feel isolated, and very easily this makes for rifts. In a sense, you know, the very suggestion of the spiritual life somehow seems to pose a threat to people. And the reaction, I suppose, is inevitable. How often does somebody say, and I've heard this two or three times when the subject has come up, and I would hasten to add, I don't introduce the subject, it's normally as a response. And if things are going well for the person, if they haven't got any particular worries or anxieties, I can't imagine life without some problems, but nevertheless, I suppose that can be. And what's their reaction? Okay, they say, but don't rock the boat. I don't want to know. Don't rock the boat. And I have a sneaking sympathy there, you know, because as soon as you come into this world, as soon as you want to tread the deep waters, as soon as you want to broaden out and embrace these things, you are rocking your personal boat. There is no doubt about it. And it's understandable. And humanity, of which we are all a part, let's make no mistake about that, is to no small extent the product of its own past ages. And the fears, the weaknesses of so many things, of ignorance, insecurity, superstition, and it's an insecurity that ranges from physical to emotional to mental. Superstition, the sense of separateness, I am separate from you, which is a root of selfishness, acquisitiveness, rampant emotion, mass thinking. I've often felt that there's nothing more terrifying in the world than mob rule. There really isn't. All these sort of things, etc., 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 all of which constitutes much of our own past history. As Lillian said again this morning, we've all been there, we've all done it. It's all part of our past history. But it still throws a very, very dark shadow across current society. And it still exerts a very, very strong influence, consciously or unconsciously. Current society is still very much in the grip of its own collective unconscious. We individually and personally are in the grip of this same collective unconsciousness because we're part of it. But to start to tread the spiritual life is to make the attempt to break free from this. You know, I always say that one of the unwritten laws in our society is do your own thinking. You must do your own thinking. The conclusions to which you come, the ideas and concepts that you accept, can't really be the result of something you've been told to believe. You have to think about it and sift it within your own heart and mind. But to do your own thinking can be, and certainly has been in the past, a very dangerous thing. We've only got to look back and witness history, yes? Look at the Dark Ages. You thought what you were told to think. My goodness, we couldn't sit here together and discuss this. We'd all be burnt at the stake, wouldn't we? I wonder if we'd come, you know? I wonder if we'd be sitting here quite so easily. That was hanging over our heads. I don't know. But to do your own thinking poses a problem in current society. To even try or think about trying to live the spiritual life is to be in the minority. And to be in the minority can be at best uncomfortable and at worst dangerous. To step off the broad highway, however tentatively and very often it is tentative at first, is to be exposed. You're right out there on your own. It's to have the temerity, my friends, to question the very ethos on which current society is built and continues to stand. And that introduces a sense, a feeling of possible insecurity. Yet here we are, aspiring to take the early steps of a way that will eventually bring us to the Sermon on the Mount. Yes? Because that Sermon on the Mount is reflected in all the other great faiths too. And if we're going to live the spiritual life, that's where we're heading. Precepts that would, remember, precepts, not just concepts, precepts. Something that would push us into action. That could, if we would, bring healing and wholeness and peace to the world around us. And yet to try and introduce it on a general scale would probably at our present stage cause more problems. I remember reading a book many years ago called Culture Shock. And it was talking about the dangers of introducing a totally different way of thinking, totally different customs, too suddenly to people. And to produce the Sermon on the Mount in our current society, well, use your imagination. What place have such things as the Beatitudes, or perhaps in Buddhism, the Noble Eightfold Path, in our current society? And yet, you know, I want to pause here a moment. Do you remember what led up to the Sermon on the Mount? And the great one, seeing the multitude, current society, withdrew. And when his disciples had come unto him, then and only then did he open his mouth and speak. And I want to suggest that the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, is, as it stands, not for current society. It's for those who have said, Master, I will follow thee whithersoever thou goest. And the spiritual life's got to lead to that, eventually. The Great One was far too wise, far too discriminating, to expect the entire current society to adopt that way of life. But these were men who had followed him. And when he said to them, take up your cross and follow me, that's what they were trying to do. They had said deliberately, we will accept a different way of life. But then all the rules change. As I said before, everything changes. You can't really have a foot. Not when you reach that point. You can't have a foot in both camps. Difficult. Difficult. You just think of the Beatitudes, and they're difficult. And so many people say, well, how would you cope with them in the current society? I don't think you would. I think we have to gradually make our way to them, find a bridge. You couldn't plunge them just as they are. And I think the Great One knew this. And even with his parables, to those that are without, I speak in parables. But unto you, he said, to his chosen band, it is given to know the keys of the mysteries of the kingdom. And that's true of all the world faiths. There is the outer exoteric side, which is difficult enough. But for those who feel this inner prompting, who have unleashed the hound of heaven, then they move inward to the esoteric side. And it's trying to blend the two that is quite extraordinarily difficult. It really is. Perhaps, you know, I can't help thinking, perhaps it's meant to be at our stage. I think our sincerity is tested. Is it just a passing whim? Our tenacity is tested. Are we prepared to stand up and be counted when everything's against us? And somehow, you know, for you and for me, and for every really thinking person, not intellectual thinking, I do want to make this point, it's what I call deep, profound inner searching, where the heart is involved as much as the head. And I don't mean sentiment. You know, it is written that the mind must seek in order that the heart can find. And that's true, isn't it? And we need this balance. And once that's beginning to happen, it becomes tremendously important to try and find a balance between the two. Somehow to cope. Perhaps we used to think that it would be a lot easier to pursue the life of inner unfoldment right away from the hurly-burly of our everyday lives, the secluded areas of desert, mountain, and forest. But you know, I'm not really too sure about this. I'm not at all sure about it. Maybe it only seems that it would be easier. And to walk away from one's commitments and one's responsibilities, no matter how much we want to do the great things, to walk away from our commitments and our responsibilities in order to live what we may think is the spiritual life is a complete contradiction in terms. I cannot emphasize that too strongly. You know, Richard, I often say in lectures, we have doctrines, but we don't have any dogmas. It occurs to me I'm beginning to sound very dogmatic. I don't mean to be. It's just that theosophy has been part of my life for as long as I can remember. And it's so much part of me, and I do feel very strongly about this. But I think most people, most great faiths would agree at that. You cannot say, I'm going to pursue my own inner destiny, and then turn your back on your own personal individual commitments and responsibilities. Can't be done. They'll be waiting for you. And sooner or later, you've got to go back and cope with them. And it's in coping with them that we do find perhaps the answer to our need for spiritual unfoldment. I wonder if you're familiar with these words. Not to him who walks on with no obstacles in his way is the promise given, but to him who overcometh. And that's true, isn't it? And to walk away to somewhere perhaps that is beautiful and that is peaceful is not necessarily overcoming the obstacles that are in our way. So for those who have seen and felt and become aware of the, how can we put it, of the beckoning finger of a higher, deeper, more all-embracing way of life and living, who would seek this temple of wisdom and understanding, or who would again reach out and touch the hem of love's garment. And I think we need to experience both those needs sooner or later. And yet, who perforce find their place is still right here, part of and in the midst of our current society, who may, quite reasonably, don't feel ready to fully renounce current society. What then, my friends? What then? How to cope adequately with integrity in both worlds? Because after all, integrity is our most precious possession. How do we, you and I, who profess ourselves to be drawn to this way of life, how do we render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto our God that which is his due, and at the same time remain true to ourselves? I'm quite sure that in this area that we all have far, far more questions than we have answers. And when I was thinking about this, it worried me for a moment that I really haven't got a lot of answers to give, you know. And it suddenly occurred to me that perhaps really, you know, it's very much in the actual seeking of the answers, to find the answers, that in the first place will help us onto this spiritual path. The very fact that it is a puzzlement to us, and that puzzlement perhaps becomes a worry or a conflict. Somehow we have to find, if I can use an old-fashioned phrase, an honorable compromise. And it's in taking the trouble to look for that honorable compromise that perhaps we approach what I would call the approach road onto the spiritual path. That we begin to equip ourselves physically, emotionally and mentally, for the spiritual life that lies ahead of us all. It's all part of the learning process. And the thing is, you see, when we do seek to lead the spiritual life, it doesn't mean the suppression of the personality. It means using it. It means bringing into play all its remarkable and wonderful resources. Again, as Lillian pointed out this morning, there's been a lot of work that's gone into the building of these vehicles. And we need them. They are our instruments. And they have to be used wisely and well. Not suppressed, but controlled perhaps, and used. So really the spiritual life, for the time being anyway, involves what I would call the resources of the whole man. Physical, emotional, mental, higher mental, spiritual. What in theosophy we would call the love-wisdom aspects. And all of this needs to be brought into play. I'd like to quote to you from that lovely writer, Krishna Prem. He said, "For our task is to learn through experience, and it's tough going, but it is the best teacher, how to handle, to harmonize, and in the end, to master the elements of experience. Until finally, this compulsive self-identification with matter is broken, and we come to know ourselves in the freedom of our own true inner nature." It's tremendous, isn't it? Tremendous. Not to walk away, but to learn to understand and use, and perhaps to stop identifying ourselves quite so totally with a personality. Can we feel, you and I, who take the trouble to spend time on a lovely day thinking together, can we feel in this strife-torn world, this troubled globe, this suffering planet of ours, that all this is very much our business, your business and my business? We're taught, are we not, that existence is one thing. That's quite an intriguing statement. What do we mean by existence? We mean everything, without exception, that has stepped forth out of, E-X, out of the divine source. And the whole universe comes out, steps forth and out into existence from that which ever stands and is behind, below and within it. A fascinating term, existence. You and I have stepped out into existence from our divine source. Flowers, they have stepped forth into existence out of the divine source. And existence is not a lot of separate things drawn together. It is one thing. It's a tremendous thought. It's a tremendous thought. And so perhaps it could mean, perhaps it's really true, that if one person makes an effort, or really tries, or overcomes, that ripple goes out, and we get a chain reaction, you know, at the inner levels. Perhaps it really is true after all. The great one said, if I be lifted up, I will lift all men with me. And all the great teachers have done that. The spiritual path is a path to some extent of sacrifice. And I don't mean a miserable sort of thing. We're taught that it's meant to be a way of joy. I think we have to find that joy. Joy with a capital J. Like that peace and that love, it passeth the present understanding. That nothing can alter. And that's another difficulty, you see, the spiritual life. If your outside world is falling about you, as it very often does, you know, can you retain this inner joy? And that's a source of irritation to people around you too, you know. It can be, because it impinges upon you. Can we do this? Perhaps I'm taking the idea of the spiritual life too far. But, you know, when you go to a university or take a course, you have an agenda, and at the end you've got your degree. And if you're in the very early stages, you think, oh gee, no way am I going to get that. But we reach it, we achieve it, by taking one step at a time and moving consistently and deliberately towards it. And I feel the spiritual path is this. But of course, in a sense, it's the ultimate task, and therefore it's the most difficult task of all. And you know, something else occurs to me, and it only just really hit home. We've been talking about the difficulty of living the spiritual life in our current society. Our current society being everything and everybody around us. Everybody except me, that is, you know? And I'm trying to do this thing. But you know, in truth, in one respect, I am my own current society. And perhaps in the last resort, I present more difficulties to myself than current society around me. Do you know what I mean? I haven't seen one head nod. I hope you know what I mean. You know, I always say theosophical thinking will make you stretch a little bit. You know? I'm part of current society. And the things I've been talking about, I know I still have somewhere deep within me. And I have to overcome that as much as I have to overcome the resistance of the current society around me. And I think this is very true. You know, if I can draw your attention briefly to another phrase in that lovely book, the Bhagavad Gita. And I'm taking it out of context, but it belongs here. And the great one said to his pupil, a man's nature will compel him to the deed. And I first came across that lovely book when I was about 16 or 17. And I remember how that really drew me to a halt. That even after I know better, even after I think I'm changing, something in my inner nature could well compel me to the deed. Oh, for how long have you and I built up energies and momentum from way, way past, you know? And then comes a moment in our age-long history when something impinges upon us and we begin to think, oh, I see. A different light comes and we begin to understand. And we've got it up here. You say, yes, I accept that. I know better. And then, in the words of my own lodge secretary, we go out and fall down the nearest pothole. Mm-hmm. And you think, I knew better than that. And that's what I mean, you see. So we have ourselves to contend with as much as anything and anybody around me. And if I can, perhaps if I can learn to cope with my own inner fears, my own inner prejudices, my own inner securities at this outer personality level, if I can cope with those, then perhaps I'm ready to cope with current society and it will let me try to live the spiritual life. I came across this verse, sums up perhaps the, I'm going to say conflict. And yes, perhaps there is conflict. You can't think about stepping out of one way of life, making tremendous changes without a degree of conflict within and without you. But you know, I think it was Robert Browning, I'm digressing again, you see, but I think it was Robert Browning who said that when the conflict begins within a man, then he's worth something. And that's meant to be comforting, yes? Mm-hmm. When the conflict begins within a man, then he's worth something. Because he's waking up to something. He's not sort of walking through his life in that, you know, condition of being asleep. You know, ignorance can be quite comfortable until something happens. And then suddenly we know, I've got to sort of institute the alchemical process into my life. And then we get a degree of conflict. But it's the way through, it's the learning process. And when we come out of it, we'll be bigger, finer, and stronger than we were before. But that conflict occurs within ourselves and without ourselves. And somehow, we have to stand firm and be true. Not aggressively. We don't have to try and push it down everybody's throat. I've got enough trouble living up to it myself. And so, once we've hoisted our colours, we've got to keep them up there. You know, haven't got an awful lot of time for the person who puts them up and then when the storms break, brings them down again and says it's no good. It's got to stay up there in fair weather and storm. We've got to be true to what we say we believe in. And that's not always easy. And I think these lines sum it up. He that hath seen the spirit of the highest cannot descry it, nor its truth deny. Yea, though, O world, with one voice thou deniest, stand thou on that side, for on this am I.